Good afternoon. This is the Heritage Radio Network's Farm Report. You're here with Heather Hyman. We are happy to thank Hearst Ranch for making today's broadcast possible. I am very excited to have two wonderful people in-house with me this Friday for our Farm Report. We've interviewed Alec Bradford. He was one of the first farmers we had on our Farm Report. He called in from Virginia to tell us a little bit about the ancient White Park cattle breed and a little bit about the Black Hog and his farm and production. And he is here today with his daughter, Sophie, who also lends a great helping hand on the farm. And we're going to get into our conversation today by just recapping a bit about the farm and the breeds that Alec works with and move on from there. Hi, Alec.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well, thanks. And Sophie, how are you today?
I'm great, thanks.
Well, thanks for coming into the studio. So, Alec, just remind our listeners a little bit about your farm and what you do on your farm.
We have about a 400-acre operation in southwest Virginia, about 10 miles from Blacksburg. It's a little town of Allegheny Spring. We started about 5 years ago. We bought one herd of ancient White Park cows. We've expanded to where we now have both lines of the cows. We bought one set from Iowa and one set from Montana, and we keep them separated. We keep the two different separate lines so we can cross bulls and raise bulls and hopefully improve the herd on this side of the country. There's only about 400 of these animals in the states right now that are registered. We're trying to get the number up to about 1,000. So.
And when you say registered, what exactly does that mean for our listeners?
Well, we send, in order to keep the bloodlines as vibrant as possible, we have to take DNA samples, and we send them off to a lab in Alberta, Canada. And by keeping a record of the DNA, we can try to get the breed to, because there's so few breeding animals, there's a risk of inbreeding them. So if we have their DNA, we can separate and identify the strongest traits of each breed or each herd and try to perpetuate those. So,
and would that then happen through selective breeding after the fact?
Yeah, we select the bulls that's farthest away from the cows that they're being bred to. So sometimes that means importing semen from Great Britain. Normally that means we just check the DNA of the bull and the cows that she's bred, and as long as they have, you know, less than 5% of the same markers on their DNA, then that means they're good for breeding.
So cows are all female, is that correct?
That's right. When I refer to a cow, I mean a female breeding
it's
animal.
Funny too, because I mean we see so many cows and maybe not as many bulls. So all those cows out there that are milking and that are made for burgers and steaks, are they all coming from the females?
No, the ones that go for meat, at least on my farm, are we raise up males that aren't going to be breeding. You can usually put one bull for every 40 females, at least with my breed, and so all the other males that are born, we castrate them, raise them up on grass, and then take them to the slaughterhouse when they're around 24 to 30 months of age,
mm-hmm.
and then that's what ends up on your dinner table. If you're eating from a local farmer who's actually raising the animals. If you send them off, if you're eating feedlot meat that you buy at the Kroger at your local grocery, odds are that it could be a female cow, it could be a 14-year-old animal. You never really know with those.
And that's not a good thing.
That's not a good thing for the consumer or for the industry as a whole, I don't think. You can't really tell where your beef is from, and you can't really tell what the shape of the animal is in before it was slaughtered. And we're a certified humane farm. For us, it's very important to know exactly what condition the animal was in. And I wouldn't feed my children anything but meat that I knew exactly where it was.
And you mentioned your child, so she's sitting right next to you. Do you have partnering farms near you? Are you in an area that's very farm-based where you're able to kind of like do some trading and things of the sort with your neighbors so that you are always knowing where the food comes from for your family?
Yeah, well, we raise most of our food. We have large black hogs. We have a 2-acre garden. We run a CSA. We eat all the meat off the farm. We raise chickens for ourselves.
So you get eggs as well?
Mm-hmm.
Sophie's job is to pick the
eggs. Yeah, collect the eggs.
You collect the eggs. How often does that happen?
Every day.
Every day. What time?
About 4 o'clock
in the morning.
No.
In the afternoon.
We don't make Sophie get up at 4 o'clock.
All right.
She's got enough on her plate as it is.
Yep. You're in school right now, Sophie?
Yes.
How old are you?
I'm 12.
12. So you're moving on up into what grade? Is that seventh grade?
Seventh, yes.
Grade. Mm-hmm. Wonderful. Great. So then you're doing a CSA. You're providing for local farmers markets. And then you're up here in New York this week. So that means you are really trying to expand the marketing arm of your farm. Huh?
Well, that's the only way to really save the breed is to get as many people eating it as possible, which is kind of counterintuitive. You would think that an animal that's critically rare, that the only way to save it would be to not eat any of them. But unless you get people liking the meat and knowing, you know, what breed they're eating and demanding that breed, the breed will surely die out if you don't create a market for it. And New York, of course, is the largest market in the country and, you know, a great place, lots of good food people, and they they really seem to care, at least the ones that I've been dealing with.
Yeah? You want to give us some examples? I mean, I don't know how long you've been in New York or if it's just been this week, but it seems like you're definitely the farmer and the marketer. So what are some of these experiences you've had actually being able to, like, aside from your local farmer's market, come up to a city like New York or a place like Brooklyn and meet these people who are, you know, spreading the good word about the breed and your farm?
Yeah, no, there's a lot of foodies, like I said, and they seem to, actually, that's after a friend, my wife does at least half the marketing. I have to give her credit for that, or she'll get on me when I get home.
And what's her name?
Sarah.
We'll give Sarah a shout out. Yeah. Sarah Bradford. Out. Thanks for all your help. Sorry you're not here this Friday in Brooklyn.
Yeah, we miss you terribly. No, we got up early on Sunday morning, drove up here, left the house at like 3:30 in the morning, and drove straight to New York with a whole steer on the back of the truck, and in refrigerated coolers and.
So the steer was already, butchered into its parts.
Yep, yep.
Okay, just clarifying for people. They can only imagine coming from Virginia with a big steer in the back.
Right. No, that would be very difficult, I think.
I can imagine.
No, we had it all, it was all cut up and in freezers. And got to Brooklyn and unloaded a whole steer with, some pretty, I guess, excited people. They didn't have the opportunity to get this meat anywhere else. And they each got about 40 pounds of meat. We split it up 10 ways.
Nice.
And I think, you know, it's one way to market. It's like a CSA of meat.
Right, I was just going to say, it sounds very similar to that. And is everyone getting the same cuts from those 40 pounds, or does it vary?
Well, essentially, but you don't get, of course, 10 hanger steaks or 10 flat irons or whatever. So if somebody, you know, for instance, got a brisket, then he wouldn't get a hanger or whatever. But they all got, you know, a variety of cuts. Some people wanted the tongue and the offal and all that sort of stuff. So
you're even dealing with special requests.
Yeah. You can have the whole head if you want it. People will take the hides, dog food, bones, marrow bones. I mean, it's pretty interesting. You couldn't have possibly done this 10 years ago, I don't think. And we wouldn't have known that there was a market for it 10 years ago. But today with the new food movement, it seems that we're sort of organically growing. We've gotten press with Heritage. We've gotten press with the New York Post, our local paper. We have the Village Voice is doing an article on us now. It's a really good time to be a farmer if you're willing to put up with all the rest of the work. It's a good time to be a farmer.
Definitely, I agree completely. I mean, it's so awesome and interesting to learn about these breeds. I mean, you mentioned a little way back a few minutes ago about importing semen from where?
Great Britain. There's the White Park is a great story where they originated. It's the oldest observed breed in existence. I mean, meaning that the Romans saw them back in before the time of Christ. The Romans recorded, I guess it was in the 4th century, that they had seen the Druids sacrificing them in, what was it, like 42 BC. Hmm. Anyway.
You're looking at Sophie like she's the history major over there.
Well, she knows all about it, and I tell this story quite a bit because, it really is fascinating, and I think that instead of raising animals and just trying to promote them as grass-fed beef or certified humane, I think that, the breed itself is very important. And these animals, up until the 1930s, you had to be royalty to eat them. And so when I say we had to go back to Britain, that's because it's where the largest herds are. There's about 1,200 animals there, and they they can get bulls that we don't have. We can get, you know, lines that don't exist in the States.
Right. So they're kind of still the number one source. So I'm assuming there's more than 400 or 500 registered ancient white parks on the other side of the pond.
I think there's about 1,200 total in Britain.
So in the whole world, there really may be still under 2,000 registered.
Under 2,000, that's right.
Wow. Yeah. So we'd have to look up on the American Livestock Breeds Conservancy where they would fall in the category of the world in terms of endangered, critically, or rare.
They're critically rare right now. I think there's actually 7 breeds that are critically rare, but I believe that next year we're actually going to go off the critically rare list, which I think is
that due to your help?
Yeah, it's cause for a party because of my farm, and there's a farm in Northern Virginia, Sandy Lerner's farm, Ayrshire, and of course the B-Bar Ranch and Seed Savers Exchange. Between the four of us, we've doubled the size of the herd in the last 4 years.
That is amazing.
Yeah.
And now, do you all work together to kind of share information and things of that sort? You're kind of like not necessarily competitors for your market.
The market's so big and there's so few of us, there's not any competition.
That's great.
Yeah, it's we work together to try to get everybody the best bull for their herd. It involves a lot of driving around. It involves, you know, taking a trailer from Virginia to Montana. Or
wow.
From Virginia to Iowa, and then you have to turn right back around and, you know, 10 animals on your trailer. That's you know, it's something to do. I like to bring my son along for that because he's a good talker. He can keep me entertained.
Yeah, how old is your son?
Aiden's 7. And I think he's very much in line to be the next take over the farm. He seems to enjoy it.
Awesome.
He doesn't really want to go back to school this year. I think he wants to spend most of his time either catching toads or watering pigs.
What 8-year-old wants to go back to school after the summer?
Absolutely.
So what do you think? I mean, are you going to start training him now, or are you going to send him back to school for a bit?
Oh, he's going back. Yeah. We had, you know, Sophie was 8 years old and she was driving the tractor, helping me pick up little calves that were lost. And Aiden,
very
if
nice.
He just gets a few more inches taller, he'll be able to reach the pedals too.
So he's got a little bit of time to grow before we can pull him out and get him on the farm full time.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes.
But that's great news, because the one thing that's always a reoccurring theme here is the importance of young farmers and the next generation and who's going to keep these breeds alive. I mean, many of the farmers that I know I work with and I've interviewed here are raising, you know, heritage breeds of hogs. But these guys are in the Midwest and, you know, they're 70 years old.
Yeah.
They've got families, but they've got families that aren't necessarily ready to take over the family farm. So it's nice to see a young farmer like you, Alec, that's raising a really rare breed that already has an interest for the next generation.
Yeah.
And that gives great hope for the future.
There's nobody around me. All my friends who are farmers close by, we don't have too many heritage people close by, but except for the chickens. Everybody has heritage chickens these days, it seems.
Mm-hmm.
But they're all over 65, and none of them have somebody to take it over. You know, their kids, for whatever reason, if there's, you know, the economy's crappy in the area and they feel like they need to move off to get, you know, get a real job.
Whatever that means these days.
Whatever that is.
A real job.
A job that pays them enough to where they can make a mortgage or a rent. And, you know, farming is not that. If it weren't for my wife and her work,
mm-hmm.
you know, we started out with no land, no house. There was no way that we could turn a farm into making the mortgage payments within 3 years of purchase. So she's been working, you know, off the farm. I work on the farm full mm-hmm. stop.
So you've been on your land, or you've been on the land that you have for 3 years now.
It was 6 total, but my plan was to have it paying the mortgage after 4.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we're now 5 years into farming, and I think I'm just starting to see the light as far as the profits go. It's just coming in for us, which I don't really know if you were a young farmer and you really wanted to go out and farm and do, you know, livestock or whatnot. I'm not really sure how you would do that these days, unless you had some other form of income.
Yeah.
There's definitely some barriers to it. No.
I would hope that there's some way that, like, the banks could be lenient in terms of giving loans to people who want to, like, you know, help keep these breeds alive and do something for, you know, American agriculture. I don't know if those things exist right now.
Not really. No, the farmers, the FSA, the Farm Service Administration, says they have young farmer loans, but you still have to have some pretty impressive credentials in order to qualify for those loans. Who knows? The next farm bill is not coming up for another 4 years, and so far I haven't seen anything that gives me much hope that there will be money available.
Yeah, but, and I would assume even the grants and things of that nature must be really time-consuming and things, and, you know, competitive. I mean, there are probably a lot of people trying to apply for the same one grant just to get a farm or something going.
Oh, yeah, and if you're working an 18-hour day...
When are you going to
write you going to sit down and write a grant? I mean, I have a hard time keeping my checkbook balance. You know, I just kind of hope everything's works out some months because, you know, I don't... Especially in the summertime, I don't get to be inside. If I want to see my kids, I have, you know, they have to come out and find me and sort of keep
help
walking
you.
And talking. That's, yeah, it's absolutely true.
Yeah, I hear that. Yeah. Now, what you know, you say you are greatly expanding, you know, the production and where you've started with the white ancient. What do you see, you know, as your plan for the future with the ancient white cattle and also with the black hog, which is another rare breed?
Yeah, the large blacks, that I think that may be the most profitable, and that's probably the future of the farm. We want to get the white parks up to 40 breeding animals in each herd and have, like, you know, a total of, you know, 80 calves a year.
Okay, and that would be 80 calves, and that would mean you could bring 80 cows to market?
Approximately 40 cows. You expect half of those would be female, but, you know, a few of those females wouldn't be up for breeding. So, yeah, 40, 45 animals a year. And the pigs, of course, we could do 70 to 100. Then they stay on pasture. They do really well. But as far as I want to keep the size of the herds at 40 because that's about all I can personally handle, and it's hard to find reliable help.
Right.
You can, if you offer internships and people can come and stay, then that's pretty popular. But to find good paid help is a real issue.
Have you got an interest, or is there any way someone could contact you if they're interested in staying on a farm?
Yeah,
your farm.
We had an intern last year who was down from Warren Wilson College. She did a good job, and she, you know, we gave her a room and board. She ate with the family most nights.
She helped cook.
Oh, no, I'm the cook. No,
really?
Yeah.
You're the marketer. Well, aside from your wife, you help cook, you help with the farm. When do you sleep?
I don't sleep all that much these days. But.
Well, let's give someone a website or an email address. Maybe there's, I can only assume that there would be plenty of people willing to come down and help or at least learn and get a feel for the breed or even see this breed. We're going to be adding pictures to our website soon, so I hope to be able to put up on heritageradionetwork.com a picture of this beautiful breed of cattle so that people can really see what kind of animals we're talking about here, because not only do they taste amazing, I've had the opportunity to try this beef, but they're beautiful, majestic-looking animals.
Yeah, no, the wide horns, wide rack of horns, and black points on a white coat. They're really nice. You could find us at leapingwatersfarm.com. There's a contact link, and I think at the Heritage Food Site, sometime quite soon, we'll have a
profile
up as well.
Will be up there for sure.
Yeah.
Great, wonderful. So the future of your farm's success and is lying, hopefully, on being able to market hogs, the black hog. Is that because they come to market faster?
They come to market faster, and you get more, you get 12 pigs approximately every litter, 12 pigs twice a year, and you have six sows. That's, 140-some pigs. And we can sell off the females again, and we keep the males. And, that amount of meat for that little amount of time, you can get them to breeding size, it takes 2 years, but for eating size, you can get them ready in about 10 months.
Perfect. And you don't have to keep that many back for breeding right away.
No, we don't have to keep any back for breeding for the first, like, 6 or 8 years.
Because, wonderful.
You know, we just stick to the same number of sows, and, you know, they get fat and lay in the grass and quite happy.
And just get ready to keep the next generation coming
that's
on.
Right, that's right, that's yeah. Right.
Awesome. And then how many, so you have the sows and then the boars, right?
Yep.
And then you need how many boars for how many sows?
We just split them in two different groups. We have one boar for three, although I think they can service closer to 10.
Wow. So yeah. Your cattle are a little more lucky, I guess, than the pigs.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. They don't get quite as much harrow.
Nice. Now let's talk maybe briefly. We're here at Roberta's. I just dropped about 5 pounds of ground beef in the kitchen, which I know the chef is really excited to talk to you about once we're done with the interview here today. Let's talk a little bit about the taste profile of this ancient white park beef and why and how we can attribute it to the practice on your farm.
Well, primarily, if you get a store-bought steak, the taste or lack thereof is in the fat. Mm-hmm. That's where, you know, that's why people eat the Kobe beef. And
because of the intramuscular and the way that the fat...
marbling and how the fat assumes more of the flavor of whatever the animal's been fed. So if it's a grain-fed animal, you can taste the white fat's very, you know, succulent and juicy. And with the heritage breeds and the grass-fed animals, the white parks are peculiar and fantastic in the sense that they can marble off of, you know, they get lots of fat deposits off of grass. We don't have to supplement anything unnatural into their rumen in order to get them to market size. And so so what you taste more of in the white parks is that the actual meat, the red meat, it's a beefier, meatier flavor. It's something like your grandparents might have eaten before the days of industrial ag. And you can taste they eat wild onions, they eat wild garlic, you know, they eat timothy and clover. And
that's just because this is what's popping up on your land?
This is what we plan to have pop up on our land. Yeah. We make sure that there's, you know, a nice variety.
Wonderful. So they're not finished on anything?
No. We just put them, you know, we finish them. We basically butcher them according to their look. Mm-hmm. So
when they look like they're...
when they look like they're ready. We don't have any, like, set date that we says this cow has to be ready or this steer has to be ready for the abattoir at, you know, 18, 20, 24 months. Generally, we wait until they look, till I can look at their condition and say, okay, they're over 1,000 pounds, mm-hmm. and they're, you know, vibrant and whatever, and then we put them on the trailer.
But there are laws that would say you have to have them, you know, for mad cow purposes before a certain age. Is that something that?
There's 30 months in the States. Sorry, but there's 30 months in the States. You have to have an animal. You can't have any bones in an animal after 30 months, but you can still eat ground beef from an animal that's, you know, 4 or 5 years old.
Okay, that's just to clear that up. Yeah, because you're like, just there, you know, he's getting to be really old, but he doesn't look like he's ready to go yet.
Right, of course, there's no possibility of an animal that's just eating grass of ever, you know, getting mad cow BSE. It's not possible. That only comes when they're eating back cow parts in their feed.
Right.
And, you know, that definitely does happen, but...
not on your farm.
Not on my farm, no.
Good. Well, that's what we like to hear. Yeah. Hence, everything that you've put into the ground to make sure that you know what your animals are eating, just like your children.
That's exactly right.
Wonderful. Well, yeah. I guess these animals are your children in a sense.
Yeah, indeed. I spend a lot of time. I have a lot of wives to take care of.
Yeah, for sure. Definitely. Yeah. So about how many animals would you say you have on the farm right now, including your chickens, everything?
Oh, over 300. 80 cows.
And you have two pieces of land, right?
Yeah, we have two separate farms, which works out well. We can do rotational grazing on both farms, and if, you know, they're both on the river bottom, so if one happens to have, you know, better grass or a different mixture, we have plenty of options to make sure the cows are always getting the best feed possible, and they're close enough together where I don't have to, you know, truck them for half hours and.
Right. Oh, because I was just going to ask, how do you move them from like one? I mean, I don't know if you call it a paddock on your land, if that's the right term.
Yeah, paddock's right, yeah.
How do you move them from one place to the next?
I just walk out there and call them. They know me pretty well. I go out there and say, "Sook cow," and they'll start walking towards me. And wherever I go, they'll tend to stay about 10 feet behind.
Really? What was that term?
Sook cow.
What does that mean?
I don't know. My granddad always said it when he was moving cows. He had this old farmer that worked for him named Rur.
R-U-R-L.
He was, golly. That was a long time ago. And my grandfather would, he'd always say, "Sook, sook, sook out," when he was moving them. And I guess
it works.
I just picked it up. So
cool. Yeah. So that's like a little family, passed down to the generation. So I didn't realize. So was your father a farmer as well?
No, we skipped that one generation. We had a farm in my family for 6 generations in the States.
Wow.
And then my mother grew up on a farm.
Okay. So you didn't really skip a generation.
No, but he didn't. My dad didn't farm, and he didn't have a farm to pass down to me. My grandfather had a stroke when he was, 75, and he sold the farm at that point. So I was actually farmless for 10 years, from 19 to 29. I didn't have...
What did you do in those 10 years?
Oh, I lived in New York for a little while. I went to Italy and worked in a vineyard for a little while, and, generally suffered... It wasn't the life I was hoping for. I met my wife, and she wanted a farm, and we figured we could do it together. So
awesome. So then you kind of had to start from scratch.
Yeah, we started from scratch. It took a whole year just to clean up the place, get all the old trucks and cars and whatever and off the farm, fence it, put water on it, make it ready for animals, and then then the next year we bought our first herd and our first horse.
And then yep. Did you start having kids?
Yeah, and kids came along. Two kids were already in the package, and two more since then. So
wonderful.
Yeah, we have a flock.
And a herd. Mm-hmm. And what else do we got going on?
I think it's a sounder of boars.
A sounder, that's a sounder. That would be the word?
Yeah, I think that's right.
Wonderful. Yeah, every week I try and get a new vocabulary in the farm dictionary out to my listeners, you know, because I'm still learning the difference between an ewe and a lamb and a sheep.
And the heifer and the tom and the barrow, yep.
Exactly. Yep. Well, this has been a pleasure having you on today. Was there anything that we didn't bring up that you might want to our listeners in on that you've got going on?
Just if you can go out and find a farm locally that you can support by your patronage, then you should definitely do that. There's the only way that these farmers are going to make it is if people show some interest in it. And it's really hard for a farmer to get out, even if they go to the farmer's market, to get out and drum up enough customers to keep their farm viable. Mm-hmm. So that's all.
So just keeping those relationships alive, getting out there, visiting your farmers, keeping the interest, trying something new, don't be disalarmed by the taste of grass-fed meat just because you have never been, able to eat it before from your local grocery store.
Or if you have bought it before and you didn't like it, then go find somebody who's doing a rare breed, an animal who's always been raised on grass. Black Angus these days are very hard to finish properly unless you have the right genetics.
So just
come out.
Yeah, definitely. Give it a try. And thanks again to Alec and to Sophie for coming in today. Thank you, Hearst Ranch, for sponsoring this edition of the Farm Report. And next time you're up in New York, we'll look forward to having you on again and to see how it's going with the Black Hogs and the continuing expansion of Leaping Waters Farm. So everybody, enjoy the weekend, and we'll see you next time.
Thanks, Heather.
Thank you. Bye.